All right, so this is May 29th, 2012. This is podcast number 4, I believe. And today we have Justin Wilson and Andrew Cox is joining us again today. And JJ is out today, which we don't need him anyway.
Yeah.
It's all good. So, starting off today, we're going to try and stay on topic this time around, which isn't going to be too hard since JJ's gone. So that guy can then just divert you left and right like nobody's business. So the guys have compiled a list. I was completely brainless. I didn't have anything. And so the first thing in Justin's list he thought would be an interesting topic to talk about would be microtik maintenance tasks is what he's saying. Checking on the health of flash, normal operation temperature, etc., and then various tools you would use to do that. And so what do you use, Justin?
I use cacti for most things. I graph if it's got a fan, I'll graph the fan voltage, which I don't have very many of those left. I haven't found very many, and I haven't, I guess, researched very many MIBs for temperature and things like that. Usually, I'll put the I'll watch the board in its environment for a couple days and establish kind of a baseline, and then use a site monitor or other tool to do the voltage and the room temperature and things like that.
Cool. How about you, Andrew? What do you usually use?
We also have a cacti server set up for. We don't necessarily monitor fan voltages and things like that, because a lot of the stuff we do is on x86 boxes. But monitoring CPU load and memory usage, just to keep an eye on those and track them over time.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a huge advocate of cacti. I mean, if you hit my site, the very first tutorials I had were cacti tutorials. I started using that stuff about 8 or 9 years ago. Just randomly found it, started using it really quick, and introduced a friend of mine to it named Jimmy. And Jimmy is a PHP like self-taught programmer. I think he taught himself PHP when he was hanging drywall or something like that. Just ridiculous, doing construction work. And anyway, he started making modifications, and now he's actually one of the core developers for cacti. So a lot of the plugins that seem oddly specific to, say, a data center or something like that, or networking focused, I could say, hey, Jimmy, it'd be really cool if we could do this. And then a couple weeks later, he would say, oh, you mean like this? And here's this plugin, perfect. My favorite version of Cacti is actually Cacti Easy, the letter E and Z, and I'll put a link to it. But it's an ISO that you get, you throw in a machine, formats a hard drive, installs Cacti, installs CentOS, installs all the plugins, reboots, and you've got a working machine right there. For us, every single port, not just wireless interfaces, but every Cisco device, every switch port we have, we monitor and trend over time. And then it's got great thresholdings in there, so anything you can graph, you can say if it goes above this point, below this point, skews from a baseline, you can get alerts based on that. It does NetFlow aggregation, which Microtik will happily dump NetFlow information, so you can keep track of what types of traffic is moving through your equipment. What else does it do? Syslog collection for alerting, so anytime there's a random event, so if somebody logs into my Microtik that dumps a syslog message, and I get alerts on those kinds of things, which is good for break-in attempts or things out of time ranges that you're not really accustomed to seeing. But then I guess another big monitoring tool people use is the Dude, this random thing. I can't remember who makes it, but it's supposed to be pretty good.
The only thing I don't like about the Dude, we use Nagios and Cacti, and Nagios has a huge learning curve.
Yeah.
But the Dude doesn't seem to be as intelligent. Cacti or Nagios, you can say, you know, here's my flapping thresholds. Here's, you know, you can say it knows the difference between a site being down and a site experiencing, you know, medium to heavy packet loss. You know, it just seems to be more in tune with what goes on, especially in a wireless network.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. MikroTik, at least in Cacti, I've never used it in Nagios, but there's some really good templates out there for it that'll automatically, you know, pull in the CPU memory, flash usage, you know, how much space you have left. It'll graph uptime, and then your queues, not only simple queues, but your queue trees, which to me is invaluable for a heavy quality of service policy. It actually, you can see in each one of your sub queues how much bandwidth is moving through, and so you can compare all of them at once. You know, you can see them all in the same baseline and timelines, and see how much traffic's actually getting matched at different peak times. And I mean, it really, I can't imagine tuning a QoS policy without it. It would just be impossible to sit there and stare at it 24/7 to make sure things are staying within profile and kind of acting the way you want.
Have you guys come across a? I know they don't have it on routerboard.com that I can find, but have you guys come across specs on what is considered the normal operating temperature for, you know, such and such board? You know, I know they have a temperature range on the specs, but have you guys come across any such thing?
I don't know that I have. I know obviously the cooler you run your equipment, the longer the lifespan's going to be, and I know if things get a little too hot, they tend to explode, kind of like that, and then some of them just outright leak, kind of like that one right there. And that was a 750G that was in one of my towers. That was actually, was that the border router? I think it was the border router for one of my locations, and it just kind of melted. But I don't think I had run any router boards that actually have temperature probes in them to know, like, if they're going to skew out of baseline or not. I buy the cheap stuff.
They all seem to run quite hot as far as, like, all the passively cooled ones, but I've never really had any major issues running it in hotter locations versus colder locations. Yeah. They fail when they fail.
Yeah, we had, here in Texas, we had a record-breaking summer. It was the hottest summer, like in recorded history, and that was the only piece of equipment I lost out of everything I have. So, and a lot of the tower stuff I have are in, like, sealed enclosures, sitting on the side of a tower, just sitting in the sun. So they did pretty good.
Yeah, we have some 450s and 493s at the top of towers, mainly because, you know, we need to do VLANs and things like that, and an industrial DIN-rail mounted switch is, you know, $1,000, and you can get a, you know, 450 for a tenth of that.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, we've had some that have, you know, they've gone through a pretty mild winter, and they've also gone through a pretty bad winter, and still up and going.
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody losing their MikroTiks to cold weather, other than, I think, JJ on one of his towers had, like, a sheet of ice fall down and, like, slice something in half. Other than that, I don't think I've heard of anything.
I've seen them in extremely cold temperatures lock up, but once it gets a little bit warmer, they come back to life.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's just a, you know, kind of a power thing more than anything.
Hmm. Interesting. Excellent. Well, do you guys have anything else to say on the monitoring front?
No. Say not really here. No.
I know on the dude, I don't just use it for monitoring MikroTiks. We use it, like, in the data center too, because it's a really good, like, What's Up Gold replacement, just to do ICMP pings. It's terrific for that, you know. And then you have the web-based interface. It's really ugly, but it works really great. You know, just shows all the different icons, and, you know, if they're green, they're doing good. If they turn, you know, red, they're down. Works really good for our NOT guys.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
the web interface I've used in the past, actually having it up on a screen somewhere and just having it sorted by the offline list, so you can instantly see and have it up so everyone can see what's offline, what's just come back up, as a little NOC wall.
That's precisely what we do in our Houston NOC. We have the dude up, pulled up, and it's just up there projected for the guys to look at and use.
I've kind of used the dude as the poor man's Visio too. You know, I know everybody, you know, is bad at documentation, and know, we'll put up sites and we'll put up, you know, 3 or 4 a week sometimes, and I have no clue where these sites even are, and it gets a little hard to visualize how they're connected together. If you can just draw a couple lines on the dude, okay, you know, there it is. Make some notes within your little, sub map, and then you can always go back and use that for, crib notes for doing real documentation. But, you know, I know companies that they use What's Up Gold or the dude as that is their documentation for network maps.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say the majority of people I do work for, that is their network diagram. They'll just take screenshots of their dude and send that to me. That's their documentation method. And the only downside to that is most people don't go through the trouble of putting IP addressing, you know, in the dude to show, you know, visually what the subnets are and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Not too big a deal, just a gripe, I guess, more or less.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, I've been in big companies where no one really knows, you know, who did what, and you got to go into the router anyway. So documentation appears to be one of the last things people always do, and there's always a mad dash at the end of the year or wherever to update your documentation, or someone leaves, or I've been on several consulting jobs where my whole thing was I went in there and documented the network.
Yeah, I'm sure, Andrew, I'm sure you guys do a lot of that, right?
Documenting.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I've seen a number of networks that are basically a Visio diagram with router names on it, and the network documentation is basically a spreadsheet full of, we use this IP range here, we use this IP range here, and there's no link between the two.
It's right, just right. How does it get there?
To try and work out where.
Yeah, that's cool. Alright.
This is the next IP range we can use. So.
Alright, so, as per earlier discussion, I'm not going to let us skew too far off of the initial monitoring part into documentation. So now we're going to move on to a second question, one that was demystifying MikroTik backups. That was another one from Justin. One of the biggest questions he gets is, if you do a backup from a 450, can you load it on a 493? And what's the answer, Justin?
I can make it work. I've seen it work, but I don't know if it's supposed to work.
And how do you guys do your backups?
We do two things. We do the automated backup where it emails the backup file. It just creates the MikroTik backup file. And then I will go in every, you know, 2 or 3 months and do an export and save that onto a shared Dropbox folder.
Gotcha.
And I'll go in and I'll edit out parts that, you know, are not relevant. I'll take out MAC addresses and things like that. That way there's a plain text backup if someone needs it that way.
Yeah. And I think it was within the last 4 revisions, there's on the export command, there's actual compact option where it'll give you just options that are beyond default. So it can kind of save you the trouble of having to go through and remove all those things that, you know, you normally get rid of, like the Ethernet interfaces, because those are all default, or, you know, get rid of the, if you've got a 750 and it doesn't have any wireless, get rid of all the wireless information in there, you know, because that's pointless to have. So it keeps it clean. What do you guys do, Andrew?
We actually have a Rancid server that does a lot of the backups for us, so it keeps differential backups. Rancid, for anyone that doesn't know, is a system that was originally for it's an open source system that's used for backing up Cisco switches and router configs. But there's some work being done by people to make it work with MikroTik devices as well. Basically, you have that, give it all your SSH details for different routers, and it'll log in periodically and do that export, grab a copy of the config. I probably wouldn't... we've looked at using the export compact, but it seems as though there's a couple of things still need to be fixed with it, just missing a couple of bits and pieces. But when they've ironed that all out, that'll make it a lot easier to do our backups, because, yeah, you don't have all that... extra unneeded information in there.
Gotcha.
So does your rancid server actually go out and like SSH into the MikroTik and pull the config that way?
Yeah. So it has the basic commands to get into them and then just do an export, and it takes the full export and keeps a backup of that. And you can actually go into rancid and see when the backup was taken and what differences between this one and the last one were, so it's good for seeing what changes were made. If a site goes offline or something, you can revert back to a previous state.
That's cool. The last time I looked at it, it wasn't there yet. So it sounds like it's time to take another look at it. That's cool. A few years ago, I can't remember when it was, I wrote a Windows program that you put your MikroTiks in there with all of your information and just schedule a Windows task to run, and it'll go and it'll SSH into your devices and it'll issue the export command, just save that as a text file. I think it saves it into a folder that's the year, then in a folder that's the month, and then the name of the router, and then the day. So it's kind of a poor man's backup, but it works well enough for us. Because we don't have that many routers. We've only got maybe 30 total out in the field. So it's not too bad to keep up with. And the text files are super tiny, so it's not too cumbersome. The only thing it doesn't have is kind of the revision control, so you can see when things changed easily. You know, none of that stuff. We just, you know, go back to when we knew it was working, pull that day's config file back out, and go from there.
I think the hardest part about any of these sort of setups using different systems together ends up being keeping the IP list updated, so you know that if you change something on a router or it's got a new IP address, that you're still backing up the config. I think we run into that problem occasionally where someone's gone through and updated Cacti with new IP addresses but hasn't updated Rancid or one of the other systems. So
yeah, I always
there's no all-in-one package available.
Yeah, I always thought it would be an exceptional addition to the Dude if they had an automatic configuration backup option. You know, you've already got all the login information for all of your routers. You've already got them, their IPs. Why not just have an option, hit a checkbox and say, you know, back up my configuration at these scheduled times?
They've got the automated upgrade.
I can't imagine it being that difficult.
Do the other one.
Yeah, it seems like it would be a really easy addition. But
I'd pay for a Dude license.
You know what? I think I would too. You know, given automated backups and, you know, a few other things, I can definitely see it. And if they could make it run a little skinnier, the database file tends to get really big on the Dude.
Yeah.
It gets really bloated.
That's the problem as well with it exceeding certain sizes and not liking backing up. So
yeah.
Run our link monitoring on Cacti and try and keep just your outage monitoring on the Dude. It's more efficient.
Yeah, Cacti, it's definitely not a replacement for ICMP monitoring system. It's just that, to me, that's a big gaping hole in Cacti that Jimmy doesn't seem to give a crap about. I can't make him care about that, no matter how hard I try.
In most of the setups that I see, you know, they're using Cacti and something else.
Yeah.
That's almost always the... I know one company that's using Cacti as monitoring, and it's not working so well for them. So they're slowly migrating to, I think, What's Up. Yeah. Almost every instance I go into, they're running dual, you know, Cacti and something.
Yeah, although I'm a big advocate of overlap as far as monitoring goes. Everything I have is monitored by two servers, or two systems on two separate servers. So, in Houston, I have all of my devices in there, to be monitored in, say, Bryan College Station, and then my Bryan College Station servers are monitoring everything. You know, so multiple levels of redundancy. Anything that's doing monitoring. One facet, say if it's ICMP, I've got two things that are doing that. Or graph retention, I've got two things doing the graph retention, just to make sure, you know, that nothing happens.
Well, and you won't be able to provide that data. If for any reason you lose a server, you still want to have your outage reports and things like that for the customers.
Exactly. And, I mean, I do pretty regular backups on my Cacti stuff, so I'd only use, or rather lose, a small portion of information, but still, you know... if you're doing, say, 95th percentile billing on people, you know, if you miss a day and say that customer bursts solid that entire day, then you've just lost revenue to the company because you lost your monitoring system. So,
yeah.
They tend to frown upon us losing billable information. So,
so the question is, can you, with the MikroTik backup, can you... cross-processor?
I think the thing to really take note of, I never do the compiled backups. I hate them because you can't just open them up and look at pieces of configuration. I always do the export command, export file, and then give it a file name. But if you do that, just make sure you take the router board settings and throw those out. You know, otherwise, yeah, you might underclock whatever the next device is. Yep. And I've seen that before. I've seen people... accidentally underclock hardware, and you know, they were super upset because they got this new router and it wasn't running nearly as fast as it should, and what was the point that they spent all this money on it? And you know, it's just a little bit of education. It always makes them feel dumb, but they'll remember it next time. So so definitely get rid of the router board settings if you're moving from one platform to the other. And also, another thing to remember is in your Ethernet interfaces, a lot of people like to just clone one device over and over and over. Make sure you get rid of the MAC addressing, because if you put a device with the same MAC address on the same L2 segment, you're going to have big problems, and I've seen that before, too.
Yes.
Yep.
So I think those are kind of the two gotchas you have to remember for, I think.
Yeah, we pretty much run, you know, the same processor class. You know, like right now they're all pretty much, you know, 450 boards for most of the routers. We have, you know, several classes of tower, so most of our class of towers are two 450s. So, you know, if we have a tech out there that, you know, doesn't have, you know, very good training or something like that, we can just have him, you know, if he wants to, just load on the script and we'll fix it from there, or, you know, just use Mac Telnet and, you know, cut and paste various aspects of the export.
So why 450s and not 750s?
We've had problems with the 750s in kind of a harsher environments, just locking up. Wow. Even with clean power, we've had problems where the and we've had this more than once, where the first Ethernet interface just disappears.
Huh.
And we have to reboot it, and it'll come back for a while. But we've had that four or five different times now. And you know, I've sent support files to MikroTik and stuff, and I don't know if they've, you know, what they've done with it, but we just kind of standardized on the 450s.
Okay. Yeah,
the 450s also have the serial ports, which I personally find come in quite handy. Especially if you've got a core switch or something, just run a serial lead between the two of them and you have direct access to that.
True.
Yeah, very convenient for that. I do that usually pretty much at every apartment complex that we service. And we use x86 base, but you know, the serial port's still just as usable. Just plug your console cable in and then run it in there. Back door in. It's come in handy more than once.
Yeah.
More than once.
The other one is for people that, don't necessarily have a serial USB to serial adapter or something like that. If you're just carrying them around, you can use the SSH to serial capability and get into your equipment that way instead.
Very convenient. Very convenient. You sound like you've had to do that a couple of times.
Yeah, where's my USB to serial adapter? Or I don't have the drivers for this one. Or the drivers only work in Windows XP and I'm running Windows 7.
Yeah, I eventually bought one that had a name brand, and I haven't had those problems since. Something that, wasn't...
a name brand one. Still problems, though.
I had one where I had a generic one, and every time I connected to a device, it would work for about 30 seconds, and then my machine would blue screen, like, without fail. So you had to fix it really quick, or not at all, was basically the gist of it.
I had one where I bought them off eBay they came straight from the company, and I plugged them in, and they had a little LED on it, and as soon as I plugged it in, the LED would light up for about 2 seconds, and that was it. And so I finally read the directions after I'm on my third one, and it says you must install the driver first or else you will damage the unit.
Weird.
I'm like, really? So it must, it must have, the driver must have somehow stepped down the voltage or something. Wow. But it was in big red letters, install driver first.
The warnings they put on routers. Put in the CD and follow the instructions first.
Oh, that's like when my wife tells me to ask for directions to go someplace. No, we're going to see what happens.
We're winging it.
All right, so the next question I thought was pretty interesting was one from Andrew, and it was his thoughts on MikroTik training. Is it worthwhile? And so do you want to lead up to this one?
I noticed there's been a couple of discussions on both the MikroTik Facebook pages, a couple in mailing lists as well, about the worthiness of MikroTik training. And I've actually been asked by a couple of people over the years, what's the training like? Is it worthwhile getting? Should you be spending money on it? Or is it just the same sort of thing that you'd learn online? Personally, I've done two MikroTik training courses now, the MTCNA and the MTCWE, so the basic one and the wireless one, both of which, while a large part of the information I felt I already knew, it was good that they go over, or the trainers I had, they went over the correct ways to do things as far as MikroTik was concerned. And they also end up teaching you little things that aren't necessarily listed in the manual or documentation, little tricks and tips and things like that. With regards to it being MikroTik training versus third-party training, I don't think I would have got approval to do third-party training, just because my work was paying for the training that I did. I do feel there's a lot of merit to going up to your boss and saying, look, I want to get 3 days off to do this MikroTik training at the mum or something like that. Whereas if I was coming up to them and saying, oh, there's this third party doing training, we get a certificate from them, but not from MikroTik at the end of it. I don't think they'd be as willing as they would otherwise. I don't know what as a trainer, Greg, I guess you have a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my own perspective on it. I've got my own opinion, obviously. Everybody does. And I've been asked, is it worth doing the training? I guess a good example would be somebody said, hey, I've got a really large network. I've been doing static routing and a lot of bridging, and I need to implement OSPF, and I need to do it the right way. And they said, if I take the routing the routing class and end with a certification, am I going to know how to do this? And I had to be honest with them and say, no, you're not. You're not going to understand how to do it. And the reason you're not is because the MikroTik certification test covers a good chunk of information. It goes from, you know, static routing to equal path or equal cost multipath routing, and then BGP, OSPF. You know, so it covers so many things, and the classes are generally 2 days, that there's no way somebody can properly teach you to engineer an OSPF network, you know, the proper design principles. The way what they have to do in that 2 day time period is they have to teach you kind of the just the most basic things about each individual subject according to what they expect you to see on the test. So they're really just preparing you for the test. To me, is that a complete waste? No, I don't think it's a complete waste. It's going to introduce you to a lot of topics, maybe give you some directions to move in. You weren't really sure on how you should kind of be doing these things. It should give you some ideas on things to look at and directions to move, but it's definitely going to be something you're going to have to do more research on at a later date. You're not going to learn how to do that in the classes. So to me, I kind of feel like some people are obviously going to go to these things and feel, you know, like they didn't get their money's worth. I think a third party person, you know, that was a certificate that wasn't a MikroTik, they could say, look, here is an OSPF class that covers design and implementation and troubleshooting, you know, and at the end of it, you'll get your, you know, OSPF certification. And I can see a lot of people being interested in that, you know, from maybe from a consultant's perspective that's going to do the training. They may not be able to get as many people in those specialized classes as they would if they did the big broad classes. But, you know, so it's kind of a catch-22, you know. The trainers aren't going to want to do it if they're not going to get enough people and make the money. But the people really want that level of granularity in the education, you know. They want to be able to do these specific tasks. And so the MikroTik method isn't going to get you that granularity. And the third-party method, you know, you're probably not going to be able to get as many people per class, so is it going to be worth your while to actually put it on? And like you were saying, you know, will your employer pay for this person to do the third-party training? I think you'd be a lot more prepared for that specific subject, you know, and you'd be really ready to implement those things.
I think as well, my understanding of it's always been that when I go to do MikroTik training, the topics that are covered, I always feel that I should have my own knowledge of how those work, but the training itself is teaching me how to use those features on a MikroTik device. So, for example, going into just the basic MTCNA training, which is simple things, how to set up a MikroTik, how to add IP addressing, firewalls, things like that. You can't go into that not understanding how IP addressing works, or not understanding how basic routing works. But what they're teaching you in there is they're going over the basics for everything again, just to give everyone who may not use them from day to day a refresher, and then they're explaining how to utilize those features on a MikroTik device. I guess that's what I would expect out of the routing course as well. I'll hopefully be doing that routing course later on this year. So,
I think
with regards to what you said, I wouldn't be expecting to learn how to properly do OSPF, but I would expect to learn more about how to do it on a MikroTik device, having my own understanding of how OSPF works and the best way to do it.
Well, see, I'm assuming that at some point, you got a book and you started researching, you know, and you're not an average guy. So you have to quit thinking that people think like you, because people don't think like you. They're not. You're here, and most people are here, Andrew. So a lot of people need kind of sort of like that hand-holding portion. I mean, that's absolutely where I learned all of my networking was from books. I actually doing the Cisco certifications. Because they're so hard and so lengthy, and there's so much material that they put out that they teach you really well, and there's no MikroTik documentation that goes into that amount of detail, especially not in the training classes, you know. to cover that amount of material, let's say in a Cisco book, if you're just doing the routing, and they pretty lightly cover it, you're looking at, I don't know, 600 pages of material. And when you go to a training class, you're looking at maybe, I don't know, a 40-page kind of pamphlet. Yeah. So these people need to get the education somewhere, and they don't know where to get it, so they go to these classes expecting to get that education to learn how to do it. I think the underlying thing to walk away with is, Andrew, you're not normal.
Well, one of my biggest...
I'm upside down.
Upside down. One of my biggest gripes is, you know, I've been through 2 week-long Microtik classes now, and the second one I went through was, the only reason I really did it was so I could take the test and get the certification. I don't want to have to sit through, you know, fly to somewhere and sit through, you know, a week-long class. I would rather have a study book and pay them to take the test. And that seems to be a very big no-no with Microtik. They don't even want to entertain that idea. And I think that could be another revenue stream for them. You know, sure, it's not going to be on the same level as Cisco. But, you know, if I had a study guide and I could prove to my employer, you know, hey, I'm going to take these, I'm going to study for these Microtik tests for, you know, the next 6 weeks or whatever. You pay for me to take the test and I want a raise after I pass it. You know, that's an incentive for people to, A, use Microtik, and B, save the company money.
Yeah. And that's absolutely the only reason I was able to get all my Cisco certifications all the way through is because I could just go and get a book, study, and go to any Pearson VUE testing center and take it. If I actually had to pay the money, because I had to pay out of pocket for everything I did. The company didn't sponsor me on any of this stuff. So if I had to out of the pocket and try and take vacation, it wouldn't have happened. You know, I would have never been able to do it. And so the way Microtik does it is very foreign to me, having to force you to go to a class. Like, I can pretty much guarantee I would have every Microtik certification by now if I could just get an outline of what the test looked like, so I would kind of know what areas to study for, and then just run to a Pearson VUE testing center and just knock it out really quick.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you would see, you know, more people implement Microtik. I have a friend of mine who works for a major university. They have Microtiks throughout one building, and they're kind of frowned upon because the only training people can get on them is either A, going to a class, or B, buying a book from basically two people.
Yeah, and I know the online training option is kind of frowned upon by Microtik, from what I understand. I don't think that really... They don't really like the online versions that people are doing.
Well, and it goes back to it's not officially supported either.
Yeah.
I can understand that there'd be concerns about the quality of people that are then getting certified, whether people are doing it themselves or whether they're cheating or something like that. But, I mean, I guess there's got to be other ways to look at it and other ways around that. Even the one-day testing has been raised a couple of times. I've seen by different people just going very quickly over content that for people who are already familiar with it and having the test on that one day rather than spending a whole week going over things that people already know.
Yeah, if I could go to the MUM and spend one day and, you know, take tests, I'd go for that.
I would too. I would show up early. You know, a couple of days early to do that stuff.
Yeah.
If I could.
So I think that goes back to, you know, kind of the question we were asking, you know, is a third party going to, you know, be better than, you know, the official supported? Well, not if the official line says, okay, we're going to be a little flexible about this. You know, you can just take the test. Sure, you might pay us, you know, a bunch of money, but, you know, people would take that option, and then these third party things might not be so much of an issue.
Mm-hmm. The other problem for someone like me is that I mean, we've only had one mum in Australia so far, so actually getting a chance to do different certifications is, like, you only get a chance to do one each mum. I did one the first time MicroTik was in Australia. I flew over to Las Vegas to do the second one that I did. The next one, apparently they're going to be back here in October, so I'm aiming to do a third one then. But if you can only do, one every 6 or 7 months, I mean, that's... Theoretically, if they, like... At the moment, they can't schedule more than one or two courses any time because there's not enough people, and they have to just pick whichever one people are most interested in. So yeah. it makes it really difficult to get them done.
Yeah, I think if you had some method to go at your own pace, you could do some real high quality training materials, you know, and then let people just mm-hmm. pour over those and really learn the equipment. I mean, and the equipment's so cheap, you can afford to build a lab. You know, like Cisco stuff. If you, and I'll put some screenshots in my lab. It's ancient stuff, and yet and it's because the only thing I can afford to buy is ancient stuff. Like the new certifications on the XR code. I think the cheapest thing I can get that'll run it is something like $3,000, and I can't afford that. You know, but the MicroTik stuff, I can buy a stack of 750s. That's no problem. You know.
Stack of 750s and a couple of rubber bands.
And I know some people do it virtualized, but I like the feel of plugging in the cables and actually doing it and breaking it down. I think there's a lot to be gained from that. You know, it teaches people kind of the KISS principle. You know, keep it simple. That if you're having a problem, start at the cable. You know, because you might have. Mm-hmm. You know, I think. That's lost when you use simulators and just everything virtualized. And
well, that's one thing, you know, Cisco does in the CCIE lab. You know, they might go, you know, clip one of the pairs of the Ethernet.
I've heard of them physically doing that. I've heard of them pulling it out and putting scotch tape over the end of the cable and plugging it in, doing weird stuff like that.
And I just looked on my MTCNA certificate. It says it's valid for 3 years. So, you know, in another year, my certificate's going to expire. So then what?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have to take the class again just to get my little piece of paper.
Although, I don't know if you take a higher level one, does that automatically recertify your MTCNA? I'm not sure if it works like that, but it might. I mean, that's how Cisco does it. That's how a lot of people do it. You know, as long as you're...
worthwhile checking out.
Yeah, as long as you're moving up in your certification, they just go ahead and those entry levels, they let those recert.
Hmm. Well, we'll have a MicroTik representative in the next podcast.
You
can pose all your questions.
There you go. Yeah, I have no idea what time it would be over there. I'm assuming they would get fired if they showed up on this thing. So probably.
we won't make anyone.
With you, Greg, if you are going to certify people, do you have, you know, these are the set in stone requirements? You have to have a week-long class.
It's kind of however you want to do it is really.
What's to prevent you from saying I'm going to have a one-day certification class? Is there something that prevents that, or is it just kind of an unwritten rule you don't do that?
No, I mean, you'd still have to fly up to wherever it is and do the one-day certification. But then I think I don't know, because they're real cautious and picky about those kinds of things, you know, because they are afraid of people cheating and getting certifications. So... they might actually invalidate teaching status for trying to do something like that.
That's what I wondered, if I that know. Was, you know, kind of an unwritten, you know, you just don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I would... If they would open things up and allow, especially for, like, really legitimate online stuff, I would build a ton of content. I really would. I mean, I've already got a bunch of stuff out there, but it really does move kind of from the perspective of Andrew, of I know how to do all these network things over here on this brand, and I know the principles. How do I do those specific things really quickly in a MikroTik? And that's kind of the view I always took when I was doing those intro ones. But if we are given the ability to actually certify online and do all that stuff, I would do like those really in-depth things, you know, on just specific types of routing or just specific actions. You know, I would actually go through the trouble of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have to go to the point of I'm putting out a brain dump or whatever. You know, just, okay, here's the topics we're going to cover. You just need to know it all. And, you know, we might have 6 or 7 or whatever different tests, and you just, you know, you don't know. You would spend more time on the tests than probably anything else once it was set up.
I think what I would do is I would use the outline from, say, the routing class, and I would put all of that knowledge and actually teach you how to do the OSPF, and then towards the end I would do a recap that would be basically the coverage. The slides that I would have in the regular routing class would just be the recap part, which you would have already learned. But so if you know how to do OSPF, you're comfortable with it, you just skip through the part where it actually goes in-depth and teaches you everything, and you just hit the kind of the brief, you know, brain refresher, kind of, these the way MikroTik does it sort of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that way you could structure it for everybody. So, you know, it can be as in-depth and as long as you want, or if there's certain parts you want to zero in on to actually learn. I just, you know, to me, I see so many people getting these tests and they don't have the knowledge. You know, they may actually pass the certification, but they don't really have the fundamental knowledge. And that's, to me, if you're training and people are coming out of your class, they should know how to do what the class was about. You know, I don't know. It's just, to me, that's just the way I look at it.
There's no, I guess the CCE, CCNA and things like that, or ones where you actually have to work on an example lab or something and build a network, really test people's knowledge, as far as I'm concerned. Whereas this one, yeah, you're seeing one example of how it could work and how to use it on MikroTik, but for someone like the person you mentioned before who wants to know how to convert a statically routed network to an OSPF network, there's no understanding of how they would do that specific thing. Whereas you look at some of the manuals that come out for Cisco, for Juniper, and it'll be like a 2,000-page book, and it's got every example of every configuration you could possibly attempt.
Because most of MikroTik's information is a wiki dump, and here's the commands to do things, but not when you use this command versus this command, or why would I use this command? I don't understand fundamentally. What's a sham link in OSPF? I have no idea. I see that the command is there, but I have absolutely no idea. You know, so it's just a lot of knowledge people need to have imparted to them. And it seems counterintuitive to say to somebody, okay, here's how you do it in MikroTik. Now if you want to learn how to do it, go get this Cisco book. Go get this other vendor's book and learn how to do it from them, because they do a kick-ass job of showing you how to do it. They will teach you how to do it. But they'll teach you the Cisco way. They won't teach you the MikroTik way. So it's, you know what I mean? To me, it's like, I don't want to tell people to do that. That drives me crazy, you know? But right now, you have to. If you want somebody to physically learn it, you have to send them to a different resource. And I just, that bugs me.
Well, and it's just like, you know, when I did my Microsoft test, there was, you know, the joke was, there's the Microsoft way, and then there's the way we do it in the real world. And I see that across several vendors. You know, this is the Cisco way, this is the Juniper way. You know, MikroTik's a little more open about it, but they even still have their this is the way MikroTik. Here's their thought process.
Yeah, and yeah, every vendor's going to put their own spin on it. What do they say? Victors write the history books, right? So like Cisco, they're the obvious victors. So everything they write is from the Cisco perspective, you know, because...
True.
You know, so it's... And everybody's going to do that to some degree or another. And most of the raw information that you learn is good no matter what vendor it is. You know, it's just the dialect. How do you actually implement it in somebody else's product?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Do the two work together, or are there proprietary extensions?
Right, right. And then, like, Cisco loves to say that wait is a proprietary extension. on BGP as one of the path attributes. But if you look at Migrate thing, there's a wait option in there. So yeah, other people are using it too. Just because you came up with it doesn't mean, you know, it's just your own.
Okay.
Cool. So that's the training section, I guess. And man, that's pretty good. We're closing in on an hour, so we'll probably have to save some of this other stuff for next week, because I doubt I'll be able to come up with anything for next week either. Kind of brain dead. So I think something cool to do right here towards the end of our cast is just kind of catch up and see if you guys have done anything cool in the last week. You know, done anything interesting, seen anything maybe that you wanted to share. Who wants to go first?
Does it have to be relevant? Because I'm pretty cool all the time.
I would say it doesn't have to be relevant. And since Andrew, since your name's alphabetical kind of both ways, first and second name, I guess you go ahead and go first. I know you've been... I gave you a hard time about Diablo last week and that you were up too late playing that, but I think you were actually doing a deployment, right?
I was doing a deployment when you guys were having the talk, but yeah, I actually got a day off work when Diablo came out. I've racked up nearly 80 hours on it now, so...
Really? Have you beaten it yet?
It's terrible. Yeah, we've got up to, for anyone that played it, we've got up to Inferno. We're still working our way through Inferno, which is the hardest difficulty. So.
Okay.
If he wouldn't have said that, I would have had no clue. I had no clue what Inferno was.
Yeah, for us that have real jobs, Andrew, where we work.
Okay. The other thing I've been working on, which is a bit more real life for everyone, I have a couple of remote control planes, so I just fitted out one of my planes with a GPS system and an autopilot, so it can basically fly itself and follow positions that I give it, and if it drops out of signal range or whatever, it'll fly back to base.
Is it the Arduino base? Well. Is the Arduino base one?
It's similar. I think they actually use an Arduino controller in this one, but it's not the open source Arduino one. It's one by a company called Range Video. So,
and you've been putting video cameras on these things too, right?
Yep. So I'm flying it using the video screen. I have a little setup that I take out with me.
So that's pretty cool.
I watched one of your first videos on YouTube, and it almost made me nauseous. It was just kind of
yeah, that was just my bad flying. So. But the good thing about this is it's got a method called fly by wire, so I can which makes it basically stabilize as you're flying, so you can pull all the way to the left or the right, and it'll go. Get a nice clean video.
That's cool.
That's me.
That's pretty
Greg,
cool.
Greg, you're next.
Oh, alphabetically, I guess I'm next. Yeah. What had I done? This weekend, it was kind of, here in the States, we had Memorial Day on Monday, so it was a holiday for us. Thursday night, rounded up the kids, and we all drove to San Antonio. It was like 3.5-hour drive, and then we went to SeaWorld.
Saw the pictures, yes.
All Friday, yeah. It was kind of busy, but man, it was hot, and it was just long days. Small children, kind of, it sucks the life out of you. Saturday morning, we drove back, and we went out of our way to go to this gas station called a Buc-ee's. I know you don't know what that is. It's primarily here in the South, but it's redneck paradise. It's like the size of like a small grocery store, but it's nothing but like beef jerky and like fatty sausage and like giant roast beef sandwiches, and they have these things called
fireworks.
I don't think they sell fireworks. They sell like polished rocks and these things called beaver nuggets. And beaver nuggets are, it's like Pop's cereal, like with quadruple the sugar, and it's just ridiculous. Everything is bad for you. It's everything that's wrong with the South. Basically in
I'm
one
still
place.
A little bit confused. What's a gas station?
a petrol stop. How's that?
Petrol.
There you go.
Petrol station, mate.
There you go. She is. So we did that, and that's about all I can think of right now. Yeah. How about you, Justin? What have you been up to?
Probably my biggest excitement is I spent 7 hours on a tower Thursday in 90 degree heat, and it was a 180-foot tower. And as I'm climbing up this tower, you guys know what a peg tower is, right? It doesn't have a ladder; it's got offset pegs. Do you have monopoles there, Andrew?
As in what? Just like a telephone cell tower with the pegs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what the peg tower thing is.
Yeah, they're very difficult to climb because your 2 feet are never side by side like on a real ladder. So I'm climbing up this ladder and it's missing pegs. and I get about halfway up this tower and it's missing cross members. And I'm like, okay. So I'm up there doing work. We hauled up six ubiquity sectors and some backhauls with shields and all kinds of stuff. And I get down and I ask this guy owns a heavy equipment company that the tower sits on. And I asked the guy, I said, what's the deal here? And he says, well, I used to come up with my bulldozer and you see those, there at the bottom, and he says, I used to fold this tower over with my bucket truck. It's a 180-foot tower that he would fold all the way over.
Wow.
And that's unheard of in the tower industry. So he said, yeah, we ran into it with the bulldozer a couple times, and we dropped it a couple times, and I'm like, great. So that was my excitement, the death tower.
God, did you take a bottle to pee in while you're up there?
No, it was so hot that everything I drank, I sweated out.
So what you're telling me is you wore diapers.
Yeah, they were adult
space
diapers.
Underpants.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, space underpants. So that was pretty much my excitement, and I got sunburn out of it, and I'm a big baby, so... My wife had to put up with me for a couple of days.
That's cool. That's cool.
Just stand next to white towels or something. It makes you look tan. This is coming from probably the whitest guy in Australia. So,
yeah, I was about to say, you had remarkably little color to you last time I saw you in Vegas. I think really the big news for this week is Andrew has facial hair now. And it's quite masculine and manly. I can't keep my eyes off of it.
Yeah, I don't get asked my ID when I go drinking.
Because the legal age is 16, right?
No. Drinking age here is 18.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's not Ireland, or no, you know, you come out of the womb. When you're
Ireland, yeah.
I can't make any jokes. I got an Irish boss. But I think he gets a bowl in the morning and puts Cheerios and then whiskey. And then that's how he starts his day. You know what? He's been over here 10 years. And whenever I talk to him in the morning, he says, top of the morning, laddie. And so I think, are you saying that to patronize me? Do people really say that over there? Because I don't call people and say, yeehaw, how you doing? You know what I mean? Is he just playing to the stereotype? Or do they really say that over there? I don't know. That's just like Andrew doesn't say g'day, mate.
Yeah.
You missed the beginning of the call. Like, I said it three times. No one was listening.
You're ridiculous.
Like, I'll just leave. I've got to feed the kangaroos.
Some shrimp on the Barbie.
You got to go spar with them? Go box them? All right, man. So I guess that's about it. One of the things I kind of briefly brushed on was last time was what would you guys think about doing a live stream? And I haven't heard any feedback from anybody one way, like other people. Obviously, you guys don't give a crap what we do. But I was thinking it might be kind of a cool way for people to interact, you know. Obviously, it would only be chat-based, but they could still, you know, see our conversation and interject stuff as it went. I don't know if you guys would... I don't know if we could actually get anybody to show up. That would be the...
We'd have to be careful, though. Normally, guys, we cut out, like, 10 minutes of Greg just rambling about crazy things.
It happens. I just start going, and I can't stop. I don't know why. And you guys don't say anything. You need to give me a visual cue. Just...
They cut out all my jokes, too, so...
That's for the best of everyone. That's... Yeah. Wow. I don't think they're really jokes. It's more or less just pun after pun after pun. It's generally...
I'm a pretty punny guy.
Oh, I knew that was coming. Horrible.
Walked into that one.
Yeah, I did. That's ridiculous.
I think it would be a good idea. It's like maybe a... You know, I follow a podcast that's for G.I. Joe stuff because that's what I collect. And they do, like, a couple times a year, they'll do a... like a phone-in show type thing, but it's, you know, it's chat-based.
That'd be cool. Because I know I watch, like, Twitch TV and Justin TV all the time, and people streaming live with the chat going, and, you know, some people stream every day, so it's pretty comfortable format, it seems. The only thing, I think, is it can get a delay up to, like, 15 seconds sometimes worse, so it can take people a little while to respond. So you'd really have to just continue to talk the way we do and then answer people as they interject things, I guess.
Satellite delay.
Yeah, something like that. All right, guys. Well, I guess... one last thing is I finally got the audio-only podcast RSS feed working on there, and it's pretty blatantly obvious because there's these huge images that say click here for the podcast feed. So I guess any of you guys want to try it out and let us know how it's working. I want to make sure it's working. So I guess that's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bonza.
And now you can dance, Andrew.
This will be like the X.